On today's episode of Doctors Who Create, our guest is Dr. David Nathan. Dr. Nathan is the founder and first president of Doctors for Drug Policy Reform, formerly known as Doctors for Cannabis Regulation. He created the Universal Cannabis Product symbol with his son Eli and is currently a practicing psychiatrist in Princeton, New Jersey. Welcome to the pod, Dr. Nathan.
Well, thank you so much for having me, David.
So I want to first talk about your experience in founding a nonprofit as a physician. Can you tell me a little more about Doctors for Drug Policy Reform, what its mission is, and what it does to further it?
No, absolutely. So our official mission is serving as a global voice for licensed health professionals and scientists, advocating for evidence-based drug policies and best practices that advance public health, reduce stigma, and especially minimize harm. So we're not so much a pro-drug organization as we are an anti-prohibition organization, realizing that the criminalization of drugs has really been a disaster for our country. And in fact, so far from being a benefit to public health to try to stamp out drugs, it's actually been a detriment to public health insofar as it has perpetuated the poverty of the impoverished. And nothing limits healthcare access more than poverty. And so it was that kind of paradox in seeing how drug policy worked in the United States that eventually led me to feel like it was an irresistible pull to do something about what I saw as bad policy.
Gotcha. So, what are some of the activities that the members of Doctors for Drug Policy Reform or D4DPR do to further that
Sure.
mission?
Yeah. And it's all the things you might imagine. And because we're a small organization in terms of leadership, though we have quite a few spokespeople out there, we can pursue whatever direction that we think is going to be most helpful. So that includes writing. So the writing of op-eds and letters to the editor and articles in other media, doing interviews with the media. This good example right here. Also, so we do speaking engagements to live audiences. We really like talking to physicians because they're often our constituency and the people whose opposition to change we want to overcome. But we also spend a lot of time talking to the lay public because we feel like of all the groups in the drug policy debate out there right now, doctors and scientists are the best suited to actually speak truth to power and speak truth to nonsense when we see policies that just don't make sense. And we also
So,
have testimony in, gosh, probably a couple dozen states and also the US Congress. We spoke at the Judiciary Committee at what was essentially the first serious discussion of cannabis reform in the United States or in the United States Congress. And I should back up a little and say that, of course, as you were saying in the introduction, we started as Doctors for Cannabis Regulation. That was the name of the organization as it was founded. We always had the idea that we were going to eventually expand our mission if we were successful to tackle other issues such as other drugs and psychedelics and things like that. But early on, we chose to focus solely on cannabis because, to me especially, that was the low-hanging fruit in drug policy reform as doctors were concerned. So, doctors might wring their hands a bit, myself included. What exactly is the best policy to reduce harm for people who are addicted to opioids? Not those answers can be very complex, but the answer as far as what to do about cannabis policy among physicians that I knew, it was very straightforward. It's, well, this shouldn't be against the law. If alcohol is legal, if tobacco is legal, both of those because of the impracticality of making them illegal, then why would we think that the ban on cannabis would be a good idea? And of course, 80 some years of cannabis prohibition has unfortunately proven correct that it really was a mistake from the outset to try to ban a drug that people are going to use anyway and have been for decades.
Awesome. Yeah, and I think in the recent years, I don't know if you saw a few days ago that President Biden pardoned thousands of people for using or possessing marijuana. And so, yeah, in the recent years, there's been a lot of progress made, especially for marijuana. So you decided to broaden your scope and expand it to different drugs.
That's right. And the rationale there is that, it's not as though we've finished with the cannabis debate. That's still ongoing. Obviously, we haven't gotten federal level decriminalization, legalization, or regulation. But at this point, a majority of US states have legalized cannabis for all purposes, for adult use as well as medical. And so that tide has turned. And I would say that along with our allies, Doctors for Drug Policy for Reform, in its previous incarnation of Doctors for Cannabis Regulation, effectively neutralized the vocal opposition of organizations like the American Medical Association and the American Psychiatric Association. And you notice I don't say that we got everybody to change their minds on cannabis policy, but what we did is to present enough evidence, enough logic, to persuade doctors who were opposed to stop opposing the legalization and regulation because their ideas are not better than our ideas. Not that the regulation of cannabis is or would ever be a perfect solution to the problem of cannabis misuse, but certainly it's a better option than having an unregulated supply and uneven enforcement of cannabis prohibition in a way that is very racially biased. And so, in our work over the years, we haven't necessarily persuaded all of our opponents within the scientific and medical world, but we have gotten them to basically shut up and stop saying that that we're better off with a prohibitionary system when they can see that that's simply not the case.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. So, how were you able to assemble all these doctors on your side and a unified board of directors and financial sponsors, donors when founding D4DPR or DFCR at the time?
Sure. It was in some ways easier than I expected, some ways harder than I expected. So I was actually sitting at this seat in my office, at my desk, having a conversation with a pioneer of drug policy reform within the medical world. And that's David Lewis, who is an addiction specialist at Brown University. And Ethan Nadelman, probably the pioneer of drug policy reform, put me in touch with Dr. Lewis to talk about the prospect of starting such an organization. And I still have that piece of note paper where I wrote down 501c3 because I knew nothing about nonprofit corporations and how they worked. And I wrote down all of the ideas that he was giving me. And he said, David, don't underestimate how much work this is going to be to start a nonprofit from scratch. And I can remember saying to him that, no, I get that. And I'm not saying this is definitely going to work, but I am saying that when it comes to something that I'm this passionate about and that I am this certain about, I can be really tenacious. And so that tenacity carried me through a lot of long hours of solo work in the early phases of DFCR, now D for DPR. And if you hear me use them interchangeably, please forgive me, but you'll understand. And so, what I started doing after having these initial conversations is looking around to who would be the physicians that other physicians couldn't really dismiss as being crackpots. And so some early people we got on board was former Surgeon General Dr. Joycelyn Elders, who is one of the godparents of the organization. She's actually still around and she's still on our honorary board. The Dr. Lewis that I told you about, he passed away a couple of years ago, but also made major contributions. Other physicians and board members we got early on were people who were really willing to roll their sleeves up and put in the effort. So we had what is essentially a working board. It wasn't so much a board of people who could donate a lot of money. It was people who could donate their reputation or lend us their reputation and donate their time. And that was really big. And a piece of advice I got from Ethan Nadelman, he's the reason that I got into drug policy reform my first year of medical school. He said, you know, when you're building your board, put your friends on the board. And by that, he didn't mean, you know, the meatheads that I knew back in college and hung out with. He meant the people in this advocacy space who I got along best with, because it's those people that you'll work well with. And our initial board was very much like that. And then as time went on, we had fewer big name folks who were on, were busy with other projects as well as putting in some time to DFCR or D for DPR, and started getting more dynamic younger physicians and advocates and PR people who, again, were willing to put in the time, the creativity. You know, this is doctors who create, and we need creative types to think about what is our messaging, what is our optimal messaging, and how best to get our message out there, what media, social media. And so we still have a very active and lively board that our board members at board meetings tend to say, wow, this is really an amazing group of people. And I think that's, well, first of all, a tribute to the new president, Brian Adenoff, but also just a tribute to the spirit of really pursuing what is passionate for all of the people around us. So to get back to your original question, it very quickly went from being me kind of pushing to get people to join, and, or maybe it's the other way around, pulling people in. It went from that pull to basically other people pushing to get in. And that was a wonderful thing to see, because there was no organization like DFCR. And in the initial idea of starting DFCR, as with other projects I've had, my reason for pursuing this as opposed to another topic is the kind of old baseball adage where the player asks the coach, hey, coach, where should I hit the ball? And the coach says, hit it where they ain't. And that's always what I've tried to do with these projects, is do something other people haven't done yet. Look for something that is a need that has been unfulfilled. And DFCR, because it was one of those kinds of projects, really got legs very quickly. And here we are 7 years later since our launch, and as active as ever.
Awesome. So you were able to put these prominent physicians on the board and in the organization and build the credibility of the organization. And now it's people asking to join.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's one of the things that's really dear to my heart, is the degree to which other physicians in getting busy with D for DPR, other physicians who are interested in drug policy reform, they take ownership of the organization. And it's not a they, it's a we, when we talk about the actions of the organization, because we make it what it is. And being a smaller, leaner organization is also, I think, inspiring to the board members and spokespeople who know that their opinions within the organization really make a difference. So when you can see your work translated into articles and interviews and TV and radio and testimony all around the country, it by itself helps draw more people in and get even more people involved.
I know that you've testified in front of Congress on cannabis regulation while you were still president. I'm curious as to know what the congressmen and women's perspective are in DFCR's work. Have you had any conversations with them to know how receptive they are about your work as a reform advocate?
Absolutely. And well, I think at that level, where the Congress people all have staffers, they all have, you know, very well considered positions and constituencies that we may or may not agree with, but they're very invested in this subject because it's a very high profile subject in drug policy reform. And so the Congress people who were supportive, which were mostly but not exclusively Democrats or left leaning, and the Congress people who were opposed, again, mostly but not exclusively on the right leaning or Republican side, they had questions that very much reflected a sort of already formed point of view. But what I think the testimony could do and what our messaging could do for that highest level of legislators is to help the legislators in a room hear the arguments being made. So, for example, Congressman Gates, Matthew Gates, asked me what was probably the most challenging question, which was right out of the talking points of the opposition. So we know where he got the idea to ask me about, and this is just one example, how about that increase in emergency room visits by children in newly legalized states, states that had allowed for the legalization and regulation of cannabis? Those numbers are way up. And so as physicians, we always call it like we see it. That's kind of our responsibility. And that's very much in our ethos as well as our mission, to not simply represent some political point of view, but represent the evidence and represent the science. I said that Congressman Gates, you are absolutely correct that those numbers have gone up. And in fact, in some states, it's 2 to 3 times what it had been before. What you need to understand is that that's not necessarily a bad thing, because kids were accidentally ingesting cannabis before states legalized. But before states legalized, parents were afraid to bring their children to the ER, because if you had somehow allowed, and this is the sort of biased point of view, but if you allowed your child or made it possible for your child to ingest an illegal substance and you take that child to the ER, you will be immediately referred to Child Protective Services. And so parents didn't bring their kids. And now that it was legal and they wouldn't necessarily get in trouble, they bring their kids. Not only that, but they're bringing their kids for comfort measures, because as you may know, as many of your listeners may know, cannabis is not a poisonous substance. So, you know, the kid may have a very unpleasant experience with the accidental ingestion of cannabis, but it will not lead to their death. And so, and that, and a couple of other ideas, I presented to Congressman Gates, and his point of view now seems to be much more pro reform than it used to be, certainly more than it was in 2019 when I spoke before the Judiciary Committee, and he got the chance to ask his question. And you see that across the board, that you're seeing a shift in legislators. Those who were opposed or opposed less, those who were somewhat opposed have been neutralized, those who weren't so sure now realize, yeah, we're better off regulating cannabis than not regulating it. And so the conversation changes, and you'd like to think that the testimony at least helps with that. And it certainly doesn't seem to hurt.
Yeah, I think on the voter level, people would be surprised to see that even the majority of Republican voters, though not as much as Democrats, are in favor of legal marijuana. But I don't think that's reflected in DC as much, but slowly it's changing.
Yeah. And, you know, part of the reason for the creation of D4DPR is my realization that physicians were actually not, so it wasn't just legislators that were kind of behind the public on this issue, that hadn't progressed as much as public opinion had. It was the physician, the medical community as a whole, which of course the medical community and the organized medical community of associations like the AMA or the APA They're mostly older white men in charge, and that tends to be the demographic least in favor of change. And so it's not surprising that physicians were a bit behind the public. They were trailing behind the public on this issue, and that was another reason that DFCR was so important to the conversation, so that we could hear the position of doctors who weren't simply towing the party line and saying drugs are bad and the people who use them are bad and the people who sell them are unworthy of their freedom. Well, let's look at this a little differently and take a broader point of view. And getting not just legislators, but also physicians to kind of wake up to the reality of what regulation looks like in contrast to prohibition. That's where we seem to have made the most progress. Because, as you say, virtually every public demographic you can find, any way you split the public, whether it's Democrats and Republicans, or left-leaning and right-leaning, or by age group, pretty much every group now has a majority of people who favor cannabis regulation over prohibition, and who favor drug policy reform generally over the status quo of criminalization.
Yeah, and to talk a little bit about evidence-based public health policy, I'm taking a healthcare management course with Dr. Molly Candon, and I remember one of the barriers to implementing evidence-based policy is that researchers are isolated from the policymaking process. So I think it's awesome that D4DPR is trying to bridge that barrier.
Absolutely. Because I think what happens in the absence of physician voices is that you have non-scientists debating science policy. And you really need the input of the medical community, in the case of healthcare, in a way that is at least intended to be unbiased. Of course, nobody's unbiased. But some groups of physicians are more biased than others. And I would argue that, the traditional medical associations were very biased in favor of the drug war, because it was seen as being a mechanism by which we were going to help our patients by eliminating drugs. And of course, it was an absurdity from the beginning. It never worked. But for a long time, organized medicine was just beating the drum of the drug war and not really proposing new ideas that could be better ideas for managing the actual harms of drug use. So, for example, despite the drug war, overdoses have just kept going up and up and up. It's not because the policy is working, it's because the policy's not working. We drive the market for drugs underground. We then see even more dangerous substances like fentanyl that is incredibly potent, or carfentanil, which many people haven't heard of, that is even more potent and lethal. And when we as physicians can say, hey, wait a second, there's got to be a better way to deal with drug misuse than to simply ban it. So, for example, why don't we give out test strips to drug users so that they can test their heroin to make sure that there's no fentanyl in it, because that'll kill them? If we had safe consumption facilities, which Canada is experimenting with, some places in the US are starting to flirt with, though again, there's a lot of opposition to it. D4DPR is here to say that we cannot let perfection be the enemy of the good. We cannot let some unrealistic ideal of a so-called drug-free America, which is almost insultingly simple, oversimplified, we can't let that perfection be the enemy of the good. And the good would be if we can actually start preventing some of these overdose deaths, tens of thousands every year, including many high-profile celebrities that we all know about. Celebrities are dying despite their wealth, despite their access to healthcare. They're dying because they're using an unregulated supply of various drugs. They're losing their lives because of the stigma around drug use that keeps them doing it in secrecy and often by themselves when they're most vulnerable to overdose. So insofar as D for DPR can help reduce the stigma, can help foster safety measures, then we are going to see tens of thousands of lives saved rather than lost. It doesn't solve the problem of addiction, but certainly prohibition hasn't done that either. And so if we can start by saving lives and reducing harm, then we can start to tackle the idea of, hey, are we giving kids realistic education about drug misuse prevention, as opposed to just saying, don't use drugs because drugs are all bad and cannabis is just as bad as heroin and vaping is just as bad as smoking and all of those things will kill you equally. And kids hear that and they tune it out because they know it's not true. When we can give them realistic education and saying, okay, for adults, cannabis overall isn't as bad as, say, alcohol in terms of overall risk to your health, but it is an issue for kids. So if you're under 18 and using cannabis, you're at much higher risk for problems with it, including a greater level of dependence on it. And if we can teach kids to just wait until they start using cannabis, rather than telling them it's the devil's lettuce and anything they do is going to, you know, potentially kill them, which they know isn't true. If we can just persuade young people to wait to start using it, then we'll be a lot better off and we'll see a lot less cannabis misuse than we do today. And a cannabis, of course, is just one drug that provides us a really good example of the general principle of drug policy reform.
Yeah, I think it's super important to educate young children in school and teenagers, but also their parents and older adults on their perception of drugs and drug use, so that their opinions and doesn't affect their children negatively.
That's right. And we see in states that have legalized cannabis, underage cannabis use does not go up. It does not increase. The people who are opposed to cannabis legalization have, fortunately and to their credit, recognized that underage use has not been increasing. Now, young adult use has increased, which perhaps isn't so surprising. But what's important to note is that the legalization of cannabis doesn't lead to some huge spike in underage use. In fact, there might be some pressure to the contrary, because where cannabis is legal and your parents are going to a dispensary to buy it and bringing it home, and it's, you know, and you know that your parents are doing it, it's kind of like, you know, Facebook or other social media sites. Once your parents are on that site, it's not that cool anymore. And so to the degree to which we can demystify some of these substances that parents have been using on the sly and make it much less of a forbidden fruit, I think that you're going to see less urgency among young people to start using the drug, because that makes them more adult-like. When they realize that, yeah, it's what my parents do, it's not that cool. And that's a good step. You know, that takes us in the right direction.
Of course. Yes. Yes. I agree. And yeah, I think there's been a lot of progress made, a lot to do still. But I think the direct, quote unquote, success of D4DPR is a little difficult to measure. But what would you say is your proudest moment of being president or just being involved with the organization?
Oh, great question. And one that I have not really given a lot of thought to. I mean, we've done a few really cool, high profile, sexy, if you will, things. One of them was a great campaign that we ran with NFL players starting around 2016, 2017 to get the NFL to change its policy, which it did in 2020 with their collective bargaining agreement. They wouldn't give us the win by actually permitting cannabis use among players. But they did stop suspending players for cannabis use. And that's as close to a win as we were really expecting to get. So that was very cool to be working with all these NFLers. You know, I'm not a huge sports fan myself, which maybe made it a little better, because I wasn't so inclined to talk to all these NFLers about this game or that game that they had played in. I would just talk more about drug policy in their lives. But I also got to introduce my kids to some very cool people. And so that was a lot of fun. The two things that I think I'm proudest of having done, like I said earlier, I'm more about the written word and being able to craft a message really carefully. So the things that I feel the best about are two bits of writing. One of them was an op-ed that ran in the American Journal of Public Health, the physician's case for legalizing marijuana. And there have been various incarnations of this article for various audiences, but this is one that was co-authored by Surgeon General Joycelyn Elders and Dr. Wesley Clark. He was the clinical head of SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse and Services and Mental Health Administration. He and Dr. Joycelyn Elders and I all composed this article that I think was pretty watertight in making the case for cannabis legalization. And before there was that bit of the original treatise, if you will, or the original manifesto was a one-page broadside that we published on the day of our launch in April of 2016, and it was our Declaration of Principles signed by over 50 physicians around the country, many academic physicians with great titles, and it lays out the case point by point for why physicians should support cannabis legalization, which is a kind of a, you know, the proverbial man and gendered man bites dog story. You know, dog bites man, that story doesn't make the newspapers. But when you have man bites dog, people take an interest. And when you have physicians, doctors who are sworn to uphold public health saying that we think that marijuana should be legalized, that is going to really have an impact, especially if you have a well-crafted argument. And that's what the Declaration of Principles is. And that, of all the things I've produced, has probably been, to me, the most important written document.
You've also designed with your son the universal cannabis symbol adopted by four states now. Were you always interested in graphic design? Like, how did you learn how to do that?
When I was in med school, I was a graphics editor for an ethics journal, and that journal, the first issue being on drug policy reform, was the, one of the few moments of true epiphany in my life where I was working on the graphics and, you know, showing what it looks like to have an overstuffed jail full of people who were arrested for drug policy violations, but also showing a target trying to really zero in on drugs and representing this the best way I could. Also reading the articles and realizing, holy cow, the whole drug war is a house of cards. And it was a moment of true epiphany in my life and changed my life, really. And that was in the course of doing graphics for a journal for which I had also designed the logo for that journal and incorporated Scales of Justice and the Staff of Asclepius, which people know as being the caduceus, but it's actually a little different, a medical symbol that we all recognize. And it was those two components that I put together into the logo for Doctors for Drug Policy Reform. And it was this way of thinking very visually that got me interested in drug policy reform and eventually led to starting with a sort of the idea for a standardized cannabis information label. How do you label cannabis? Well, the best way is in a standardized way so that the warnings are there, the package is clearly labeled, and it's optimized in its visual representations for safety. And that led me to think about standardized warnings for cannabis packages. That led me to think about, well, wait a second, fundamentally, we need some symbol that everybody will recognize as being the cannabis product symbol, not depending on what state you're in, because every state had come up with its own bespoke, in-house crafted cannabis symbol, that all of which had some problems of symbology, because the folks who within state government designed these symbols were not symbologists. In almost or virtually every case that I can think of, the symbols for individual states was lacking. And so we came up, or initially I came up with the concept of a safety symbol. What are we communicating to people on a cannabis package? We are communicating that there is cannabis in the package, and we are saying that you should be cautious because of the cannabis in this package. And so how do you say caution with cannabis or marijuana? What symbol best represents marijuana? The marijuana leaf, the cannabis leaf. Everybody recognizes that as being that has the meaning of cannabis. Well, how do we say be careful? We have yellow warning triangles with black borders and some symbol inside. And so it really wasn't much of a stretch for me to think of. And then my son Eli, who is himself a graphic design and computer science major, who also has a great interest in symbols and logos, for us to kind of perfect the design of a cannabis warning triangle. I like to think that anybody who would have approached this problem in the same way would have come up with essentially the same solution, which is a black bordered yellow triangle with the black silhouette of a cannabis leaf inside. That is what became the International Intoxicating Cannabinoid Product Symbol that was approved by the standards organization, ASTM International, as the first and still only standardized cannabis product symbol. Again, like you said, it's been adopted in four states. Other states are looking at it. Some states that adopted a very bespoke symbol back when they first started selling regulated cannabis are now taking a look at using the standardized symbols so that people across states will all know one symbol and all rally behind one. And so that's a process that I'm actively engaged in.
My first impression of the symbol was that it's super simple, minimalistic. And when I was comparing it to the other symbols, I don't know if you intended this, but it almost destigmatizes the product maybe, because it's yellow, it's more of a caution rather than a red exclamation color point on the symbol, which is almost like, don't use this.
Right, which is, you know, stop signs and exclamation points. And boy, if they could, I think, you know, some finger waggers out there who are trying to tell everybody not to use cannabis would have us put all kinds of poison symbols on cannabis, even though it's not a poison. They would have us, again, create a message that is not realistic. But when you have a caution message and tell people, we're not telling you not to do it, but we are saying as physicians, you should be cautious about this because drugs are drugs. And whether it's aspirin or cannabis or chemotherapy or heroin, there are pros and there are cons, and you want to inform yourself about your use. And to be able to say so in a single symbol is a tall order, but if you can just communicate the idea of caution simply, I think that that is where all stakeholders in the space will agree. And indeed, we have an open letter that's now out there from essentially every stakeholder, major stakeholder organization in the country for the cannabis space, saying that every regulatory authority should adopt this one symbol, the International Intoxicating Cannabinoid Product Symbol, also known by its standard name, which is ASTM D8441. Very technical, but that's the name of the symbol as it would be adopted by various states. And we have industry organizations, trade organizations, we have drug policy reform organizations, we have medical organizations, all of them coming together in a way that has never happened before, where we can all agree on one solution for regulation. We can all agree on one standard. And if we can just get a foot in the door of a regulation that we can all pretty much rally behind, hopefully other common sense regulations will follow. And so it's not just about the symbol, it's also about the spirit of collaboration that I hope that Doctors for Drug Policy Reform would inspire throughout this space. You know, I like to say we are militant moderates opposing all forms of extremism by any means necessary. So, you know, we're really out there fighting the good fight for what is essentially a middle of the road point of view.
Obviously, you've had a lot of success in your endeavors adjacent to medicine, but outside traditional medical practice. So wrapping up, what would you like to say to our listeners who are thinking about maybe starting a club, organization, or even a business?
Well, first of all, and this is not an idea that is, you know, I can't claim authorship of this idea. And I can't remember where this comes from, but the concept, it's not the one big idea you have in your life that will, you know, make everything go your way and lead to inevitable success. It's lots of ideas, some of which are good, some of which are eh, and you let them go. And hopefully a couple of which really are ideas whose time had come. So like Doctors for Cannabis Regulation at a time when it was long past due for there to be an organization like that. It goes back to what that coach told the baseball player. Where are you going to hit the ball? Hit it where the fielders aren't already standing and waiting for it. Hit it where people don't expect it to go. And once that ball drops somewhere in fair play, you are going to get on the bases and you are going to start scoring runs. So you want to do something that is going to be of impact, do something that hasn't yet been done, and do something, you know, start the projects and be ready for a lot of work if you know that what you're doing really ought to be done, even if you weren't doing it. That would be my best advice, is find some good ideas, pick one, and then put the work into it that you know it's going to need.
Great. Where can our listeners learn more about you and your work?
So to learn more about me, well, you can start by going to D4DPR's website, and it's very simple. It's D, the number four, so D4DPR, as in Doctors for Drug Policy Reform. So d4dpr.org. Can find me. I have a personal website at nathanmd.com. You can see some of the other projects I've done in the world of animation and early writing systems and a whole host of fields completely unrelated to what we're talking about today. And I love hearing from people. So if you find something inspiring and you want to start a conversation, I answer my emails.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Nathan.
And thank you so much, David. I think this concept of your podcast is a great one, and I hope you continue.
If you like what you're hearing, don't forget to subscribe, tell a friend, leave a review. We would love to hear from you.
And if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can email us at doctorswhocreate@gmail.com.
Or tweet us at doctorscreate.
Or check out our website, doctorswhocreate.com, to listen to our podcast episodes and also to check out other articles and profiles of physicians who are creative.
Intro music brought to you by the band Night Float.